May it please the court. My name is Larry Jakowiak. I represent the plaintiff, Rick Ailman, in this case. And the issues we present for appeal are related to the interrogation aspect of this case, as well as false arrest for aggravated battery and then for murder and the similar.
How long was he in jail?
I believe for the aggravated battery, he posted bond within a day or two. And for the murder case, it was about 7 days.
Only 7 days before they dropped charges?
No, they dropped charges. That took about 13 months. But the bond for the murder was, I believe, at $1 million.
Is it unusual to allow someone charged with murder to be out on bail?
I don't think so at all in the Cook County Circuit Court. I've represented many murder defendants, and in this case where there's no background, there's no weapon involved, it's not gang-related, there's ties to the community. The bond was set at $1 million, and actually two of the parents who had their kids in Mr. Ailman's daycare posted most of the bond for Mr. Ailman because they believed in his cause. And
so he spent about 8 days in jail as a result of this?
Yes, Your Honor. And
it would be helpful for me if we could separate these two arrests because I think the facts might be a little bit different. You know, at the time they arrest him initially on the aggravated battery charges, bearing in mind the standards for probable cause, you know, these police officers aren't supposed to be, you know, fully trained medical personnel. You know, here's this child. He's, you know, he dies shortly thereafter. Symptoms of shaken baby syndrome is what everybody's talking about. Isn't that arrest one which is, you know, even though, of course, we know what the end of the story is, but that's not the right perspective. Isn't that arrest unobjectionable?
I think it is objectionable. And at that
Why?
Time...
I mean, what are they supposed to know, given that, although, you know, as we eventually find out, things could have happened as much as 2 weeks before, they also could have happened that day. The police don't know. I mean, they show up, here's this unresponsive small child, and here's Mr. Ailman, who's there.
And in the cases that I cite, including the Bevere versus Huckel case, there's evidence that there's children who have been abused or neglected, and there's the same inference can be made, well, there's probable cause to arrest the parents, and in that case, this court said, there wasn't probable cause. Some investigation was required. And accepting that as a standard, as I mentioned in the opening brief at least, that would give police probable cause to arrest any parent any time a child is brought to the emergency room, for example, who is suffering from some trauma.
Well, but here, I mean, again, trying to take the right perspective, Mr. Ailman calls 911. He's detained about 3 hours later, at which point Lusky knows Joshua, the child, had been in Ailman's care. She finds out from Carlson that he's got symptoms of shaken baby syndrome. Again, it's just a probable cause requirement. Isn't that enough to detain him to see if he was the shaker?
Well, at that,
I mean, I realize that maybe other people, I mean, we know too much now, but I mean, it's not fair for the police to impose, you know, perfect foresight on them.
Well, if that were the case, and at that point the police can round up, you know, every adult with any contact.
No,
with,
I mean, they go to Ailman's place. They have more than that on Ailman. He's there. He's taking care of the baby, and the baby's been shaken. You don't think the police would think maybe we better check you out?
Well, the police training and arguably the information they got from the doctors, including is that shaken baby syndrome is not a immediate lights out type of injury. The symptoms take time to develop and
they
manifest.
They take varying amounts of time, don't they, depending on how hard the child's been shaken?
Well, about all I know at that point, this was about 11:37 in the morning. They had, really had very little information at that point.
They had very little.
They knew that Aylman was the last person that had the baby. That's about it. Did they know any more than that?
I don't think so, other than the fact that the baby was taken to the hospital and allowing a rush to judgment like that to make an immediate arrest leads to arguably what happened in this case, is that when an arrest is made, the police officers put blinders on, build a case against the arrestee, and then when evidence surfaces that another person was responsible, it's too late. Person's been arrested, charged, interrogated, and then when evidence kept on surfacing, including a DCFS expert saying, you've got the wrong person, there's nothing wrong with how that person demonstrated he shook the baby, they just have blinders on or focus exclusively on the person that they had arrested, charged, and interrogated and claimed they got a confession from.
What degree of murder was he charged with?
First-degree murder.
First-degree murder? Did they really think it was deliberate?
That was the charge, and I recall that even at the bond hearing for murder, there was a mention of the death penalty.
So let me ask you about the interrogation. You're not raising a claim about Miranda warnings, as I understand it. You're raising a claim that they ignored his repeated requests for a lawyer and continued interrogating.
Correct. He was given Miranda warnings, and that's part of it, but early on and many times throughout the video, he made a request for an attorney, and that didn't stop the defendants from repeatedly going back in the interrogation room and badgering him to change his mind, which is the exact issues the Supreme Court has addressed in Minnick versus Mississippi, Edwards v. Arizona. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, they are able to do so, but only...
And this is similar to this court's Sornberger situation.
It is similar to Sornberger, and this court, as I referenced in the letter, the Rule 28J letter I filed on Friday, Fifth Amendment claims in Hagazi versus Templeton, Second Circuit case, Stude versus Everett, a Ninth Circuit case, and a similar Fifth Amendment claim was recognized by this court in Best versus Portland, a 2009 case.
So he spends a lot of time in this interrogation room with nobody talking to him, right? Don't they shut him up for about 6 or 7 hours?
I think, yeah, there's a long period of time, several hours, where I believe what was happening is Hanover Park is waiting for officers from the Illinois State Police Child Victimization Unit to come and assist or conduct the interrogation. The main interrogator was Officer Michi, who was from Illinois State Police.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I seem to count three times that he asked to talk to his lawyer. Is that correct?
I count at least
the
three.
First time, are you claiming that the first time around was good enough that even though he's explicitly said, I'm going to tell my lawyer what I'm going to do here, he wasn't purporting to ask the lawyer's advice. Now, is at that point, did they have to cease interrogating him?
I think so. As I established in my brief, at 5:14, he said he wanted to call his attorney. At 5:16, they just kept reading him his Miranda rights. Smith versus Illinois is directly on point. At 5:16, he was asked if he wanted to call his attorney. He said, yeah, we'll just take a second. Then he spoke to his attorney.
That's the second time. When he said it'll only take a second.
Correct.
At 5:20. The first time, he was quite explicit. I want to just tell him what I'm going to do here or something to that effect.
He said, before I do this, I got to call my attorney.
Okay.
And at that point, under Smith versus Illinois, Minnick versus Mississippi, the questioning, the continued reading of the Miranda rights was supposed to stop. Smith versus Illinois is directly on point and explicit on that.
Well, I think you've got a better case, Frank, than the the second and third time that he passed it. But certainly the third time, he was not purporting to tell his lawyer anything. He was going to ask his lawyer what to do, I believe. And that brings you right into the case law on the subject.
The Supreme Court and this court has held, and in at least a dozen cases, hundreds of circuit court cases, probably thousands of cases at the trial court, the standard is, did the suspect ask to speak to an attorney, ask for an attorney to be present, or reference an attorney or the assistant of attorney in any sort of way? And the standard the defendants are arguing applies is, did the person specifically say, I want an attorney present for questioning? In the arguably thousands of adjudications of this issue, that's never been a standard applied or suggested in any sort of way. This would be a new standard that would apply to these cases, directly contrary to what the Supreme Court has held and this court has held. And
I mean, it doesn't make a difference if he says in one instance, I'm going to tell my attorney what I'm going to do. That's the same as saying I'm going to ask my attorney for his advice as to what I ought to do.
Well, I'm going to tell my attorney what I'm going to do is making reference. He didn't say that in this case.
He said something pretty close to it the first time. Between the first time and the last time.
Before I do this, I got to call my attorney. Arguably, that's a statement saying I want assistance of attorney before doing this, which is being interrogated. And the Supreme Court has said that any sort of reference to an assistance of an attorney is a sufficient invocation of the Fifth Amendment right. In all of the cases where there's where the defendant's argument, oh, it was an ambiguous request, are cases where they're defending the factual scenario where they didn't allow the person to speak to an attorney and saying, well, we would have, but it was ambiguous. Here, they let him speak on the phone to an attorney. There's no argument that they didn't understand he was requesting an attorney. Moving to the probable cause argument for aggravated...
Well, why don't you save the rest of your time for rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Knotts?
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Jane Knotts. I'm with the Illinois Attorney General's Office, and I represent the two Illinois State Police officers, Officers Fallon and Meachie, in this case. I'd like to start with the unlawful interrogation claim first. At the outset, Judge Wood had asked if this case is like Sornberger, and it's actually not, because the claims in Sornberger were that the suspect's confession had been coerced and that she had not been given her Miranda warnings. Neither of those claims are present here. The claim here is that Mr. Ailman clearly invoked his right to counsel.
This shows how Miranda is used actually against defendants. It's not for defendants. They badgered him into agreeing to be questioned without a lawyer present. I mean, it's obvious. It's what they do. They're very good at this. I mean, police have learned how to manipulate Miranda so that it actually assists interrogations, and it shields them from serious investigations of coercive interrogation, because what the courts say is, oh, well, you got your Miranda warnings, right? That's the shield. Okay, but they know how to get around it. I mean, look, this guy is very upset because he doesn't know what happened to the child. For all he knows, he picked up the child and that killed it. He doesn't know. So he's terribly upset. You can tell he's terribly upset. He wants to talk to his lawyer, but he's frightened, you know. And, of course, the police maintain a very intimidating presence when they're talking to people. So he doesn't know what he's doing.
Well, I mean, let's
I don't think he gave meaningful consent to be questioned without his lawyer.
Well, there has not been a claim here that the Miranda waiver was knowing and voluntary. The claim is that he deliberately or clearly invoked his right to have counsel present.
I think that's extremely unrealistic. He doesn't want to be there, right? But he's upset. He's afraid to ask the lawyer. It'll go worse for him if he asks for a lawyer. Then the police will really come down hard on him.
Well, he may not have wanted to be there, but at this point, the police...
He's not thinking.
At this point,
the lawyer tells you to shut up, you shut up. If you decide to... you can tell from reading the transcript, this is not a person in full possession of his facts. He can't think straight.
Well, that's certainly not the claim here, that he couldn't think straight, that it wasn't a knowing waiver. The claim is that he clearly requested his lawyers.
I think it was. I think he's not thinking.
Well, but the plaintiff hasn't forwarded that claim. So the court should not.
It is not proper interrogation. Once he says he wants to call his lawyer, they should have left him alone.
Well, and they did do that.
They badgered him because they wanted to question him without his lawyer, and they know how to deal with these people.
With all due respect, I don't think that's true. I think the interrogation began, as Judge Cuddy suggested, with him indicating...
Very naive.
With him indicating that he...
I don't understand how the police operate.
Well, what I do understand is the case law says there needs to be a clear invocation, a clear statement to the police. Miranda and Edwards are prophylactic rules.
And the clear statement. These people are not in these. I mean, these people are in a difficult situation. He's under arrest. They think he's killed someone. Okay. So, but he knows enough to want to speak to a lawyer. The lawyer tells him to shut up. The police could have said, all right, you know, we won't talk to you anymore. Instead, they keep badgering him.
Well, except he never told the police that he didn't want to talk to them. He had a choice at that point between standing silent and being...
It's realistic to think he had a choice.
And as Sornberger says, you know, you have to, you can't just recite Miranda and then forget it. You've got to properly follow what it directs, and they do keep on talking to him. And it's like there is no rule of repeated invocation. No, and I still don't want to talk, and I don't want to talk, and I've talked to my lawyer.
Well, except that he never said that he didn't want to talk.
He wants to talk to his lawyer, though. What could he possibly be talking
because
about?
Because he began the interaction.
And they should stop. Then.
Well, he began the interaction with the police before they even started to talk to him. He said that I want to call my guy and tell him I'm about to do this so he knows. He had made a decision at that point to speak to the police without his lawyer present. He had talked to his lawyer.
He may have said that the first time.
Mm-hmm.
But he said he wanted to call his lawyer three times. He certainly didn't say that the third time.
Well, but at the third time.
The third time, he was seeking some sort of advice from his lawyer. And I think that certainly falls into an Edwards situation.
Well, with all due respect, Edwards says that a suspect has to clearly express his desire to have counsel present. And then Davis and Tompkins says it has to be...
specifically.
I'm not in any way suggesting there are magic words at issue here. He needed to explain to the police that do something to indicate he wanted to have his counsel present.
Surely he did, though.
You're making up the law.
Where does
Edwards say anything like that? Supreme Court.
it's in the Edwards decision. I'm sorry,
well,
I could certainly provide
the rationale. Certainly doesn't say you got it. You got to tell the fellow who's being questioned.
Well, I think...
I don't think it's even... I'm going to take issue with Judge Cudahy about this on the first thing. When he said, I want to call the lawyer and tell him I'm going to talk to you, I think that's just a garble.
Well,
you wouldn't call up your
officer...
lawyer to... You wouldn't call up your lawyer to tell you I'm going to talk to the police. You call up... Your lawyer, because you know it's the prudent thing to do, but you're so confused that it comes out as, you know, in nonsense. And then, as Judge Cuddy pointed out, then as in the second and third, you know, iteration of this, then he's at least a little more coherent.
Well, I mean, that may be what he was thinking, but you have to look at a reasonable officer in these circumstances. That's what the officer could have understood.
Reasonable officers, they are determined to question him.
Can I touch briefly on the false arrest claims?
Don't you understand that? What do you think the police are there for? To enforce constitutional rights or to get confessions, right? That's what they're there for.
I see my time
That's
is
why
about.
If Miranda is to, I don't even like the Miranda rule, but if Miranda is to mean anything, it has to mean that the judges have to be realistic about the tactics that the police use to get around Miranda, which includes badgering someone who's in a highly emotional state.
I just really briefly want to touch on the false arrest claims, if that's okay, before I cede my time to Mr. Hartigan. With regard to the false arrest for aggravated battery, there is absolutely no genuine issue of material fact, contrary to what plaintiff suggests, about what the doctors told the police at the station on the day Mr. Ailman was arrested. At their depositions, they did not doubt that Sergeant Cardona had accurately described their statements. And those statements were...
Well, they took it all back in their subsequent statement.
Well, that's actually not true. When Dr. Reyes looked at Sergeant Cardona's police report, he said he did not have any reason to doubt that Sergeant Cardona had accurately described the statement he gave at the time, which was that the injuries would have manifested immediately. And then Dr. Siegel didn't take anything back at his deposition. He continued to say that the injuries were fresh and would have occurred within the past 24 hours and not several days earlier over the Labor Day weekend, which is plaintiff's theory. And then
they modified that and qualified it very heavily, I think, when they were deposed on the subject.
I would just urge the court to look at the deposition testimony, which shows that they saw no error in Sergeant Cardona's report, and that's what the police were going on at the time. What happened 3 years later is not relevant to the probable cause analysis. And then just finally, on the false arrest for murder claim, that runs only against ISP Officer Sergeant Fallon, and here plaintiff has not challenged the district court's determination that probable cause was established by the existence of a valid arrest warrant. So he doesn't seem to contest the correctness of that decision.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Notch. Mr. Hartigan?
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Mike Hartigan. I represent the Village of Hanover Park, Officer Lusky and Officer Carlson and Officer Villanueva.
So let me start you with Officer Carlson because, and I'm focusing now on the arrest for murder, not the arrest for the aggravated battery. There is evidence in this record that Officer Carlson deliberately misled Dr. Jones in order to fabricate the evidence that was necessary for that arrest. And so even if that didn't implicate Officer Fallon, who I think is in a different position, there is this allegation against Officer Carlson.
And that's all it is, Judge. There's no evidence of that.
Well, you know, but there is evidence of it in that it all turns out to be not true.
No, I mean, Dr. Jones changed her opinion regarding the timing of the injury after she met with Ailman's criminal defense lawyer.
But
she never ruled out that the date of the accident is the same day that this child could have sustained her injuries. She was asked that question by me years and years ago during her deposition.
But
she
Officer
never
Carlson
from that.
Gave her, you know, false information.
No. The only thing, and you, if you look at the brief, the appellant brief, page 19, you know, there's an unsupported statement that that happened. There's fabricated evidence. But what evidence? He was there to attend the autopsy. She asked for more information. He went to the hospital to get CAT scans to bring them back to her so she can review them. That is not someone who is attempting to manipulate a trained physician in Dr. Jones. He is trying to collect
Jones
evidence.
His first opinion was that it couldn't have happened at the place where they were keeping the baby.
Well, and the critical thing.
And then she changed it around when Carlson talked to her. And she changed back to her old position when the guy from the DCFS talked to her.
The critical thing is
if this child was behaving normally, up running around when he's dropped off on September 9th, that's one scenario. If the child is already lethargic, you know, having already, in fact, that week been taken to a doctor, that's a completely different thing.
Judge, respectfully, that was a hypothetical question asked of Dr. Jones. If Carlson said, if this child's up and running around, would that change your opinion? Yes, that would change my opinion. He never said that. She never knew he was even there, which is, you know, it's usual because they don't remember names of officers. She didn't know what he said. The only thing we're going off of is what Carlson reported, which is her saying, yes, it could have happened that day. Cause of death, homicide, blunt head trauma, subdural hematoma, blood on the brain, shaken baby syndrome. If you look at the transcript, Judge, you'll see. It's a hypothetical question posed to Dr. Jones, who frankly was all over the place. But the fact of the matter is her opinions remain the same as they remained on the date of the autopsy, that this was murder. Okay, and he went and collected more information per her request. You know, there's an allegation or something in this brief saying he left the autopsy to come back with fabricated evidence. He came back with a CAT scan so that she can take a look at the films and
maybe,
date it.
Maybe not only. Ellman alleges that he changes the information he gives to Dr. Jones about the original behavior of the child. That's nothing to do with the CAT scan. That's nothing to do. That's what's the background against. Sure. Because, of course, if this had been a normal child and then suddenly he dies, something happened.
Right. I could speak to that, and I know I have limited time, but the issue is, in what condition was this child when he was handed over to Ellman on the day of this occurrence? There's evidence, uncontested, undisputed evidence, that he was crying, he wanted to go back to his mother, he was conscious, okay? And then the officers arrive, the first responders come, they pick up an unconscious child who was, you know, hours away from death, as we know, which was tragic. So, I mean, the issue is, you know, what was the condition of the child on the morning of, okay? And there's all kinds of allegations unsupported that this child was suffering from brain trauma weeks before the occurrence.
We're talking about Carlson's behavior. So this flirtation or whatever it was with Danielle, and his instructing her not to speak to Booker. He's the expert, right? And
he's
investigating
just
this type of case. What's
another,
that?
He's no more an expert
about
than Detective Carlson. He just happens to work for the DC.
What is this about? I don't understand.
It's his investigation. He wants to protect it. He wants to be present when she's being questioned by anybody. And that was something he instructed Danielle to do, and the mother, grandmother, Nancy. Because it's his investigation.
He's a small-town cop, right?
Detective Carlson?
Yeah. Hanover Park?
I'm sorry?
How big is Hanover Park? What's the population of Hanover Park?
I haven't looked at the census.
We have a lot of problems with police forces in small towns.
Okay.
This fellow, Booker, is some kind of expert in this type of case, right?
I don't know that he is. He hasn't been presented as one.
What do you mean? There's evidence about who Booker is. What, he works for some...
DCFS.
Does he work for...
He works for DCFS.
Yeah, right. Okay, that's they're concerned with... Carlson is not an expert in the mistreatment of children. Booker is... That's his business. Now, what is the small-town cop doing to instructing witnesses not to talk to the state officer?
They did speak in his presence.
What's this about his presence?
He's
protecting her because
he's
attracted to her.
No, that's nonsense. He's a married man with two kids.
There's evidence of that. There's evidence.
Because he's at the wake.
Well, wouldn't it be appropriate to have a trial about Carlson?
I don't think it's appropriate at all, and I don't think that's a question of
fact. I don't understand why they thought, as between Alleman and the mother, that he was the likely murderer and she not, with her history. He doesn't have that history. She has the history.
History too, Judge. No one's an angel in this case, but the fact of the matter is he was the last person to have custody with this child. The mother denied that she ever did anything. The grandmother denied this, but then later says that...
That's like saying that the doctors at the hospital were the last people to see him alive, therefore they're suspect in his murder. Anyway, your time's expired.
Thank you.
Mr. Jakowiak, how much time does he have? 2 minutes? You have anything further?
Just quickly, Your Honor. All the evidence in the case, including Danielle's history, and Mr. Ellman had no history of any sort of violence whatsoever, pointed squarely at Danielle. Immediately after this incident, Michael Booker, Department of Children and Family Services, 18 years experience investigating shaken baby cases, says, you're looking at the wrong person. I watched that video. There's nothing inculpatory about it. Look at Danielle. Look at her history. And immediately, Carlson told Danielle, don't speak to Booker. But it's not surprising.
So what about the allegation that Mr. Cardigan has made, that this statement in your brief that Carlson told Dr. Jones that the child had been all right in the morning is not true?
It's absolutely true. Booker was there at the autopsy. Booker's notes reflect that Dr. Jones reached the opinion, quote, it was highly unlikely that this happened in Ailman's Daycare Center that morning. There is no evidence presented that the kid was fine then because Booker was there and Booker knew the truth. Carlson offered to bring back some CAT scans or something, and then when he came back, he said, oh, you know what I forgot to tell you was that kid was fine when he came in that morning. He was playing with the other kids. There's no problems with the kid. And
so
then,
that's in a deposition. I mean, you cite docket 148, paragraph 35. Where do we find that statement you just made?
That's in that docket number in a deposition from Booker and Jones, and if it's not, I can supplement the record. And the district court made that finding. The district court is very concerned about that, but the district court found that, well, based on the other evidence, I'm going to find there was probable cause for the arrest. But even the district court looked at the record, looked at those documents, said there is evidence of that. And the key evidence that the defendants rely upon in their briefs and reference today as far as the doctors is, well, the doctors in their deposition, Cardona's notes were fine. Well, what was happening there is the doctors were not willing to say the police officers are liars. But the police officers are liars, especially Officer Carlson. And he lied to Nancy Jones. And arguably, a jury can find the only way, if it's true at all, which I doubt, that a doctor would issue this opinion, because that morning, September 9th, in the medical records, those doctors knew this baby had been sick all week, displaying classic symptoms of shaken baby syndrome, and combined with the subdural hematoma finding and the retinal imaging, there's no way a doctor would issue that opinion.
Tell me about the doctor's opinion of immediacy, depression, so forth.
That's what I'm referencing. It's our position that's a fabrication. What the doctors knew that morning was subdural hematoma, retinal hemorrhaging, classic shaken baby syndrome symptoms.
What did they say at the time? And how did they qualify later on?
Dr. Reyes himself has no recollection of speaking to any police officers that morning. From that evidence, a jury could infer what the defendants are saying the doctor said didn't happen. What the defendants are saying the doctor said is medically unsound. Given the history, the classic symptoms all week, and what the diagnosis was, no way a doctor would say that. The doctors in the deposition looked at the medical chart, looked at the history, and said it didn't happen in ailments. They had no new information at that time. They knew about the child's history. They knew about the CAT scans, the other results from examinations, and they said it didn't happen in ailments. There was no new information they had between September 9th and their depositions. They would not have said that.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Hardin, and thank you to, I'm sorry, Mr. Jakowiak, and thank you very much to Ms. Knotts and Mr. Hardin as well.